This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers, rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, providing support and information to anyone affected by breast cancer. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. Today's episode, we are talking to Dr. Sam Orange, a clinical exercise physiologist and deputy director of research in the School of Biomedical, Nutritional and Sports Sciences at Newcastle University, who wants to improve women's access to diet and physical activity support after their breast cancer treatment. More women are living with and beyond breast cancer than ever before, with survival rates doubling in the last 40 years. It's widely known that exercise and a healthy lifestyle can improve outcomes and survival, but there are various barriers that prevent patients from getting the support they need, including limited resources on the NHS. In a project funded by Breast Cancer Now, Dr. Sam Orange is helping healthcare professionals to refer women to community support services while developing a training package so that those services can specifically support women who have gone through breast cancer treatment. Sam, welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to have you. So, Sam, we know that more women are surviving or living with breast cancer than ever before, which is obviously fantastic news. But we also know that one in three of those women will experience persistent tiredness or fatigue, and almost half will experience depression and anxiety. And I'm sure lots of our listeners are nodding their heads right now. Before we talk about your work, could you explain how exercise and a healthy lifestyle can help with those symptoms of low mood and tiredness?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Laura. Simply put, being physically active is one of, if not the best thing that people can do for low mood and feeling fatigued and tired for a long time after breast cancer and cancer treatment. And you really shouldn't just take my word from it, but that's supported by some strong evidence. So there was a large review put together a few years ago that pulled together all the evidence in this area, and it looked at the effects of exercise, the effects of psychological interventions such as things like cognitive behavioral therapy, and drugs as well, so the effect of drugs on cancer-related fatigue. And what that large review found was that actually drugs had no positive impact on cancer-related fatigue, but both exercise and psychological interventions, again, like cognitive behavioral therapy, both helped alleviate cancer-related fatigue. And out of the two, exercise was actually slightly better. So the evidence does suggest that exercise is particularly beneficial for cancer-related fatigue. We don't really know why yet. There are some plausible mechanisms that have been proposed. So exercise can help with things like inflammation, improving the activity of the immune system. It can help with things like energy metabolism and improving fitness and reducing muscle wasting. And all those factors might play a role in how exercise can help with fatigue. But the evidence is pretty clear, and it can sometimes sound quite counterintuitive and counter to the fact in that we should, physical activity is recommended to improve tiredness when typically physical activity is the last thing on people's minds when they are feeling tired. But the evidence is, again, is really strong in support of that. And in regards to low mood too, so the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, or NICE, which listeners may have heard of, and they're essentially the NHS watchdog. They make recommendations to the NHS based on cost effectiveness of different treatments. So they recommend what the NHS should be prescribing to patients across a range of conditions, including cancer. And for mild to moderate depression, or less severe depression, that it's sometimes called, exercise is one of the first-line treatment options for mild to moderate depression. And that's on the basis of the strength of evidence supporting being physically active and taking part in exercise to help alleviate some symptoms of low mood and depression and anxiety. And that evidence is specific to people with cancer as well. There have been lots of large reviews that have looked at the evidence between exercise and symptoms of anxiety and depression, which are often common in people who are diagnosed and have treatment for cancer. And again, similar to fatigue, exercise is one of the best things that people can do for that follow mood.
I'm just going to jump in and preempt what some of our listeners might be thinking, which is, if I'm so exhausted I can barely get off the sofa, how do you expect me to muster the energy to go to the gym or go for a run?
That's a really important and legitimate point. And I understand that that would be, as you say, a first response to many people experiencing tiredness and fatigue. But there are a couple of really important points here. The first one is that physical activity comes in so many different forms. And it's probably a good point here to define or look at the difference between physical activity and exercise. Mm. So physical activity is actually any bodily movement that requires energy expenditure. Exercise is a subcomponent of physical activity that is purposefully undertaken to improve health or fitness. So for instance, going to the gym or going for a longer run. So physical activity encompasses so much more than just going to the gym and lifting weights. And it's really important to remember that anything is better than nothing. So any movement, any amount and any type is beneficial, and more of that is better. And so I tend to see physical activity as a continuum, so or a staircase, if you will. So simply just reducing being sat down, so standing up at regular intervals or walking around the living room, for example, is beneficial. It doesn't sound like much, but versus compared to just sitting down, that's beneficial. And then you can go right across the other end of the continuum when we have more structured, planned exercise, such as lifting weights in the gym or going out for a jog. And that brings us to my second important point, and I think it's important to raise that it's important to be kind to ourselves, right? And fatigue will often come in ebbs and flows. So on some days and some times after a cancer diagnosis and during and after treatment, it's very likely that during some days and times that people will feel exhausted and really, really fatigued and tired. There are other days and times potentially where people feel a little bit better and a little bit better symptom-wise and have a little bit more energy. And we can use that to accommodate how much physical activity we do. So on days where fatigue is really high and we simply feel exhausted, let's be kind to ourselves. And it might be on those days that actually doing a little bit of activity around resting. So for instance, washing up, getting up from the sofa at some intervals, walking to the corner shops to grab some milk, for instance, is actually all going to be beneficial. So that's important to remember that that is beneficial. And then on days and times where we feel a little bit better, we could then potentially consider taking part in some more structured exercise. So that might be, you know, going out for a 10-minute walk. For some people, that might be going to the gym. And if it's, I think we're all guilty of thinking of exercise and then we're picturing this weightlifter in a gym or picturing someone wearing not so many clothes, going out for a run, for instance, and we don't tend to associate ourselves with that person or that activity. But physical activity for one person can be so different to physical activity for another person. And so for some people, on days and times when they're feeling better, it might be that they want to go to the gym or go out for a run. Other people, activity might look different. That might be going for a walk with a friend or a relative or a dog, for instance.
It also might be, I often think back to what you used to like when you were little or when you're at school, because for some people they might have played, I don't know, tennis or rounders or something like a team sport when they were little, and they don't feel like they now have that access anymore that they're older, but maybe there are ways to get back into sports that people loved as well.
Yeah, you make a great point. I think it's important when people are interested in increasing their physical activity. That's not always easy, and actually can be very challenging. And it's important to remember that physical activity, again, comes in many forms, and take actually some time to reflect, what does being regularly physically active mean to me? What does that look like to me? Sometimes that's, what do I enjoy? So what do I enjoy doing? A lot of people come back and say they don't enjoy being physically active, which is fine, but it might be, you know, what is accessible to me? What is feasible to fit in? Who else can I be physically active with? So you're right. It's important to take some time and think about, what does physical activity look like for me? And there are many options to that.
And sometimes I mean, I'm very physically active, but there are times when I'm absolutely exhausted. You know, it might be because of my symptoms. It might just be because I'm working hard or whatever. And I don't feel like going for a swim or going to my spinning class, for example. And on some occasions I stay at home, but on other occasions I go and I come out feeling more energetic and feeling a bit better. Is that a thing? Is that psychological, or is there a thing that happens that actually means that exercise makes us feel less tired?
Yeah, absolutely. That is certainly a thing. And injuries aside, that I don't know anyone who's ever felt tired and then gone to be physically active or exercise who's then regretted it and thought, actually, I feel more tired now, or I feel worse. Yeah. Almost every time, the person will say, I'm glad I did that. And of course, that's not to say that that's an easy thing to do, to get up and go and, you know, and when you're feeling tired, to go and exercise or go be physically active. That's, of course, very challenging. The person, like you said, in your experience, feels more energetic afterwards. And I share those experiences as well. We're not exactly sure why that is. There's a common theory about endorphins being released, which certainly has some legitimacy to that. And there are also a lot of other theories as well. So as well as endorphins, our muscles actually, when we're active, they act as endocrine organs. So muscles don't just help our bodies move, but when we contract them, when we're active, particularly at a certain level of effort, they actually produce small proteins, thousands of them, in fact, into the circulation. And it's thought that those different proteins and small molecules might be able to have a beneficial impact on our health. And one of those things is fatigue. And that's really, I think, reassuring and a nice message that actually every time we are active, even that just one brisk walk or one spinning session, to use your example, that's contributing to us feeling better and being healthier. And I think that's a nice message to take away.
Yeah, definitely. And just before we talk about your research, can I ask you, the fatigue that we experience through cancer, having cancer treatment, is not, it's a tiredness that is not alleviated with rest, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not really, it's not proportional or related to previous activity, and it's not alleviated by sleep or rest, for instance.
That's brilliant. And because I think for a lot of cancer patients, me included, sometimes someone will say, oh, I'm so tired. And I will think, I wish I had a way to explain how tired I am that isn't just because I've been working hard or whatever. It's I woke up after a 10 hour sleep, and I could sleep all day and all week because my body is just completely done in. But it's hard sometimes to explain that to someone who doesn't have cancer. So
absolutely, I completely appreciate that. With other conditions, for instance, you know, if you have a physical injury, it's quite easy for people to contemplate that and understand that. It's easy for them to see that. But I understand trying to articulate long-lasting tiredness that is so real and so genuine and has such a large impact, trying to articulate that and have people understand the implications of that, it would be very, very challenging.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Well, let's talk a little bit about the research project that you're doing with funding from Breast Cancer Now. Can you tell us what sparked that project and what's the end goal and how does it work?
So this research, as you said, is funded by Breast Cancer Now. Research funding is incredibly difficult to come by. So what happens is researchers we put together, we have an idea, we put together a research funding application, usually in collaboration with people who have experienced that condition. For instance, women who've had breast cancer and doctors and nurses who treat that as well. It usually takes around 12 months to put a proposal together because it's very competitive. You need to find a funder where their priorities and values align with your research priorities and values of the project. So, for example, this project that we have funded that I'll talk about in a moment, we couldn't go to Cancer Research UK for that funding because their remit does not cover cancer survivorship. Their priority is preventing cancer rather than health and well-being in cancer survivorship. It typically then, once submitted, it takes about 6 months, usually sometimes longer. And then the acceptance rate, the funding rate, is around 15%. So 8 or 9 out of 10 applications that you submit will be rejected after 18 to 20 months of putting that together and waiting for the decision. And I just think it's worth raising that to listeners that, of course, there was many research projects that we would like to run, but they are very challenging and time-consuming to put together. And so it isn't just as simple as, I've got an idea, let's get some money and let's do this. I think that's probably worth raising at this point.
Of course, yeah. And just to interject, I think that so many people listening probably will have done some fundraising for Breast Cancer Now or for another charity over the years, whether it's, a coffee morning or a sponsored walk or whatever. And it's just really interesting to know what that money goes into and all the work that goes behind the scenes and how well considered the use of that money is. So, it's really, hopefully really reassuring to people to know that.
Yes, absolutely. And, this research none of this could happen without the generosity of people fundraising for charities like Breast Cancer Now. And you're absolutely right. The low acceptance rate of proposals is there for a good reason, because this money is important and we need to, or charities like Breast Cancer Now need to put that money and fund the best research possible.
On that note, tell us about your work.
Yeah, that was a good segue, wasn't it? The best research possible into our research project, of course, and bias. So our project is called Expanding into Communities to Improve Lifestyle Support for Women After Breast Cancer. And we've shortened that as PUREX. And the aim of the project, as you said at the start, is simply to improve women's access to physical activity and diet support after finishing breast cancer treatment. And we want to do that in two ways. First one is to develop a new referral pathway that will enable healthcare professionals to simply and quickly refer women into physical activity and diet support services that are based in the community. And the second one is to then train existing community service providers. So, for example, local community centers and charities, to adapt their existing healthy lifestyle programs, for example, exercise services, specifically for women with breast cancer. And I can't really articulate how excited I am for this project. I genuinely think it has a real potential for impact. Of course, I'm biased as well, being the lead investigator on this. And I thought about this for a long time before talking about research funding, before we decided to ask Breast Cancer Now and submit our proposal to Breast Cancer Now, because I believed our values aligned really well with Breast Cancer Now priorities. And what this came from was I felt it was a chance to essentially connect the dots. So there are lots of exercise services out there in the community already. I'm sure all the listeners can think about exercise services in their own local community. Exercise classes for the general population, exercise classes for people who are at high risk of falls or at risk of diabetes or have had a heart condition. And so there are those classes and services in the community already. And we know there is good evidence, as I've talked about how physical activity can support women who've had breast cancer and finished treatment. to improve things like fatigue and symptoms of depression and anxiety and improve mood. And so my line of thought was, well, can we utilize and harness this infrastructure that's out there already, this existing community infrastructure, and use that to support women after breast cancer treatment to be physically active? And that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're coming up with a referral pathway that, again, allows healthcare professionals to make that referral into community services. And then we're developing this training package to then train these existing community service providers how to adapt their existing portfolio of exercise services for women with breast cancer. So it may look as simple as a one-day consultation where we might work with an exercise provider and say, okay, this is what you offer currently. This is what the exercise and nutritional needs are for women who've had breast cancer and breast cancer treatment. And so therefore, these are the tweaks and that you can make to your existing services and how you can adapt those. And then that service will be certified or qualified to then deliver the exercise and nutritional services to women with breast cancer. And we have quite a clear vision for this project. I always think it's so important to have what you think the end goal is here and what you're working towards. And what I think this might look like is that with a comprehensive input from people affected by breast cancer, so women who've had breast cancer, but also from exercise professionals, physiotherapists, dietitians, oncologists, specialist nurses, etc., we're developing this training package. And so we want to train community service providers across the country. We think this will hopefully be scalable in the longer term, who are then certified to provide exercise services to women with breast cancer. Then what we think this will look like is healthcare professionals have a list of certified community service providers that they're able to refer women to. And then during routine follow-up care for women after they've had their primary treatment for breast cancer, women are then offered a referral to these community physical activity and diet services as a routine part of their follow-up care. And that gives women the option, therefore, to have support after finishing treatment for primary breast cancer to be physically active as part of the community alongside other women who have gone through a similar thing and can share similar experiences.
And is it are you only working with women, because you talked about after treatment, but what about women who are still having treatment because they have secondary breast cancer? Are they included in your study?
So this specific project is for women with primary breast cancer who've had and completed treatment for that cancer. This is not to say that physical activity isn't beneficial in the secondary cancer setting, because evidence would suggest that it is. Typically, when you acquire funding, you have to focus on a specific population. And there are, of course, major differences between in treatments and things between primary and secondary breast cancer. So for this project, we have focused on primary breast cancer. But we are very aware of sometimes the imbalance between research opportunities for people with primary versus secondary breast cancer. And that's something we feel strongly about and are looking to address in the future. One of my key aims in the near and long future is to develop a support program for women with secondary cancer.
What got you into this? Do you have any personal connection with breast cancer?
I don't have any personal connection with breast cancer, fortunately not at this moment in time. What got me into this, Laura, is probably a larger backstory I'm very happy to share if you'll indulge me for a couple of minutes.
Fantastic.
So I'm very fortunate not to have any personal connection with breast cancer. My background is I was a professional rugby league player, and that's all I ever wanted to do. From being 5 years old, I'm not being facetious there, I dreamed of being a rugby league player. And I signed my first professional contract when I was 16 and, as I said, played professionally. And I had several, between the ages of 17 and 21, I had several season-ending injuries. So I was in a quite a large car crash where I lost my memory and was in hospital for a while and broke a vertebrae. I had three knee reconstructions, a shoulder reconstruction, and essentially I spent the vast majority of then those 4 or 5 years trying to cement my professional sports career on the sidelines. I then decided, because of the toll that I'd taken both physically and mentally, if I'm completely honest, through injury, I decided to stop playing after my latest injury when I was 21, which would have taken another 12 months to have surgery and recover from. I remember always telling my manager at the time, and then went into the changing rooms and just wept and wept. I was really, really, gutted to be stopping playing. And I felt very lost at the time, really lost my identity, because I was a rugby player and that's how people knew me. And I really reflected and I thought, okay, what am I going to do now? And I'd gone to university on the side and in York and really enjoyed it, which was where I'm from, and really enjoyed it. And I thought, okay, how can I best use the skills and experience that I feel I've gained through a short but real professional sports career? And how can I apply that to the greatest need? You know, where can I apply it where there would be the most benefit and impact? For me, that wasn't working in sports. I didn't feel like I would have as much a meaningful impact. And for me, there was, when I reflected on that, there was a really unmet need in people with cancer, including women with breast cancer, in terms of there was a mismatch between what the evidence was saying and actually what support that people with cancer are actually being offered. And then from then onwards, I have dedicated the past 10 years to try my best to address that. And I'm very ambitious and driven, and I will continue to address that until there is no longer that particular unmet need.
Wow, thank you so much for sharing that, Sam. That's an amazing story. And I can only begin to imagine how heartbreaking and crushing that must have been, to just have lost your dream career so early on through injury. It's just heartbreaking. So, but yeah, well done you for turning it into something so positive for other people. It's a massive success story, I would say. Have you managed to get back into exercise now? Are you physically fit now?
I am physically fit, yes. I'm feeling really good, actually, of almost a lifetime of a short lifetime of injuries, and I'm feeling really good. Exercise is not one size fits all, and I avoid particular exercises because they don't work for me. And so now I lift weights. I've always enjoyed lift weights, and I think that's probably born from, and it was, but spending so much time in the physio room that I sort of trying to get back fit and strong to play on the field, that I sort of fell in love with the gym, really. And I cycle as well to try and keep fit. So I both cycle as much as I can to the shops and to friends' house and things like that. But I also do some sort of structured, purposeful cycling as well to try and improve my fitness.
I'll share a little experience of mine as well, which is slightly related to yours, which is a year ago I had secondary breast cancer in my sternum bone, and I had an operation to remove my entire sternum bone. And it was a huge recovery period, in which I'm a swimmer, and I wasn't, both before the operation, when the pain was so bad in my bones that it was affecting my swimming, then it got better with drugs, and then I had the operation, and then I couldn't exercise at all for at least a month. And for me, obviously physically, there were major, difficulties, but mentally, that was the worst period probably in my life, because I couldn't do the two things that make me feel good, which are working and exercising. And I was sitting at home depending on others to do things for me. And I couldn't cook either, because I couldn't pick up a pot or chop a carrot. I'm now fortunately much better after that operation, but I'm having another operation this week, which will put me out. I won't be able to swim or cycle for a few weeks. And I also have a recurring groin strain injury, which seems to be that no matter what I do, every so often it just keeps coming back. And then I can't swim or do things for a week or so. So I just wanted to ask you about what we can do mental health wise when we can't exercise. And I know that's a really hard question.
that's a really interesting question. And I haven't figured that out yet either, Laura. And it's physical activity. I guess just drawing on my experiences for a second as well, is that I genuinely feel privileged every day that I have a body that moves. I'm able to move in the way that I work on a fifth floor in a building, and I have not used the lift yet because wow. I've got a body that can. I'm privileged that I have a body that can walk up those stairs. And physical activity does so much for me mentally as well. I tend to be physically active little and often, because I get even 15 minutes of physical activity brings that benefit. And if I can have that every day, then I try my best to. So, and I've thought a lot about this from the injuries that I have had. And so there's nothing that either comes to mind or is in my scope of expertise, I think, to suggest. The thing that I would suggest considering is remembering again that I keep banging this drum, but that you don't have to go to the gym and do 45 minutes of intense spinning classes to be physically active. So what might, whilst you're injured, whilst you're post-surgery, for instance, actually what we need to change gears in those contexts. And so what might be represent physical activity in those contexts might be just walking around around the block, around the street and back. And that will, you'd probably be surprised at how much benefit that actually brings, just being able to do that. And I think it is just around shifting gears at that time, which means, okay, my body won't allow me to do what I used to be able to do or what I want to do at this moment in time, but focusing on what you can do. And I think that sort of embodies a positive mindset as well, which has its own independent benefits. Not everyone loves exercise. Not everyone is motivated to exercise. And you know what? That's absolutely fine. So in that context, what I'd always suggest is almost trying to disguise physical activity as something else. So I'll use my own mum as an example. I'm sure she won't mind. My mum has never been someone who's been overly physically active. But what she used to do with a friend, and this lasted for many years, is most evenings, particularly in the spring, autumn, and summer, is go for a walk with her closest friend, who's now moved away. But during the many years she was here, and again, my mum's never someone who's ever stepped foot in a gym and would not be consciously physically active, but she walked a reasonable distance every night after work because it was catching up with her dearest friend. And I think that's just one example of how we're able to be physically active, but it's not something it's not our primary goal of that activity, but it is a side consequence of that. And I think there's something a lot to be said about that, that again, it doesn't just have to be going out for this run to get fitter. It might be an activity that's catching up with friends or something similar, but you're also being physically active.
Absolutely agree, yes. And it also made me think of who you mentioned just before our recording, which is Jeffrey the dog, who I believe is in the room with you. And obviously walking a dog can be a great way of disguising your own exercise, because you got to walk that dog.
Absolutely. And just on that, Laura, that's absolutely my experience as well. In other words, there's certainly, I think, days without having Jeffrey the dog that I would probably struggle leaving the house with long hours at work and working from home sometimes, as I'm at home here. And the dog certainly does. I have to be out. And I probably give it 25 minutes, Lauren. He's probably jumping on my lap saying, I need to take him out. So I will watch out for that.
So going back to your study, often we think of a researcher in a white coat, in a lab, working on their own. But your study involves working with real breast cancer patients. What's the process like with those patients? What kind of involvement do you have? How do you find them? And what information are you getting from them?
Yeah, great question. It's absolutely, you know, incredibly important to work with women who've experienced breast cancer when developing a support program for women who've had breast cancer. That sounds, of course, so obvious when you say it out loud, but there's been so many instances in the past where researchers like me have developed support programs for instance, people with cancer and not spoken to people with cancer. And then we then have no idea whether it's acceptable to them, whether people are going to enjoy and take part in that support program. And so we're really taking a comprehensive approach to make sure that everything we do, this full support program, is very much grounded in the views and the needs of people who've experienced breast cancer. So we have what we call a patient and public involvement, or PPI group, that are following the entire process throughout the whole 3 years. We've got two patient leads who are essentially chairing and managing our patient and public involvement group, and they're working with another eight fantastic women, so 10 in total, who are working with our research team. And they will be, they're actively involved in making decisions and shaping the direction of the project. And so they are just as, if not more important than any of us researchers who are developing this support program. And that group will, again, work with us throughout the duration of the project. We then conduct in the first instance, so we're actually starting next week, is holding some focus groups with other women who've had experience with breast cancer to really better understand their experiences and views of physical activity and diet support after their breast cancer diagnosis and after finishing treatment. We're also doing or holding focus groups with other, what I'd call, stakeholders as well. So exercise professionals, dietitians with expertise in cancer, oncologists, nurses, primary care professionals, to have their input as well about their barriers and facilitators of providing this support within the follow-up pathway, and exactly what is the support that they think would be best to offer in this context. We're then holding some workshops where, based on what we have learned from the focus groups, we'll essentially say, this is what we think the support program will look like based on everything we've learned. What do you think of it? We think we'll do that a couple of times and then get to an end product, if you like, where we can say, okay, we think this referral process and this training package, how we will train community service providers, is we think this is feasible and acceptable to both women and also other stakeholders like oncologists and healthcare professionals. Then what we'll do is actually run the trial with around 40 women who will be referred by their healthcare professional into a community exercise and diet program that's delivered by a HealthWorks charity who've received our training package. And we'll be conducting some interviews with some of those women and the healthcare professionals to understand, again, exactly how the referral process was implemented in standard care, what the barriers and facilitators were to carrying out that referral process, whether women turned up to the exercise program, whether they enjoyed it. So very much the person's voice who's had experience of breast cancer is so central to this project, and it just would not go ahead without it.
So in terms of timelines, when are you hoping to complete the project, and how will our listeners be able to access those better services?
Great question. Unfortunately, these things do take some time. So our project started in October 2023, and it's due to last 3 years, so finish in September 2026. So what we're looking to get out of the end of that project, we're hoping to have a program that encompasses a referral pathway and a training package that we've tested and is feasible and acceptable to women who've had breast cancer. Our intentions after that is to work out a way to roll that out and implement that. So that will probably take a little bit of work of what we'd call implementation science about how we are going to not just work with a small charity and a couple of NHS trusts in the Northeast, but how we can roll this out nationwide. That might take a couple of years by the time we have acquired funding and been able to complete that work. But I would say between 5 to 6 years, my vision for this project is to have these services embedded, this referral to these services embedded within standard care as part of routine follow-up for women with breast cancer.
Okay, well, obviously, that doesn't mean that people who have had breast cancer treatment should wait 5 to 6 years to start exercising. They should start today, right? Are there particular exercises or particular physical activities that are especially beneficial for people who've had breast cancer?
So a couple of important points that I always like to raise, and I think I've said this actually earlier, is that any physical activity is beneficial. So any type, any amount of physical activity done at any intensity. So it's all beneficial. But more is better. In terms of the type of physical activity, again, there are various different types. We usually split these into four different domains. One is physical activity done as part of household chores in the household domain. So for instance, washing up, gardening, etc. Physical activity done as transport, so walking to work or cycling. Physical activity done as part of work. That could compass any working behind a bar, for instance, and being physically active during that, or physical activity as part of leisure time. And that's essentially exercise is what we're referring to there. Now, on the caveat that all physical activity is beneficial, so done as part of home, done as part of transport, as work, or during leisure time, all is beneficial. But I believe there's something particularly special about physical activity done as part of leisure time or planned, structured exercise. Usually it is split into two different types, and that's aerobic exercise and resistance exercise. So aerobic exercise might be going for a brisk walk, for instance, usually done at a moderate intensity or above, which essentially just means you're starting to get breathless. And resistance exercise, which I know, Laurie, you're particularly interested in, and that's what is sometimes referred as muscle strengthening exercises. So lifting weights, but it doesn't always have to be lifting weights. So it could be lifting household objects, for instance, or things like using resistance bands, which typically can be quite helpful around the home.
When you said then that I am particularly interested in resistance, so this is actually something, and I know a lot of people will relate to this. I had a big operation last year. I'm in my early 40s now and have experienced all the menopausal symptoms, having had nearly 12 years of cancer treatment and now with secondary breast cancer. And so for me, muscle maintenance and muscle strengthening is, I am told, more important than anything else. And I'm also getting a lot of injuries now, a lot of recurring injuries. Where would you suggest people start in terms of strengthening and weightlifting, which, as you mentioned earlier, can seem like a really scary, daunting task for someone who's never done it?
Resistance exercise, as you said, it is the best type of exercise for muscle mass, muscle strength, and bone health. And I think it's important, again, to remember that there are no particular exercises that you must do. And I think we can all fall into this trap. I know I have, for example. That's not true. And one resistance exercise might look different to another despite having similar benefits. And sometimes that's around trial and error, finding the right type of resistance exercise that works for you and avoids, you said you had some injuries and some pain. And it's about working around those. It's about avoiding pain. And sometimes, again, it can take trial and error to find the right exercise that avoids pain. Low impact exercise can be beneficial. So you might avoid jumping, for instance. And there's a lot to be said about starting slowly and building up gradually. Again, I think we can all think, okay, we've probably all been guilty of thinking, okay, I'm going to start exercising. I need to go to the gym for an hour and do this many exercises for this to be beneficial. And it all sort of comes from some of the myths around no pain and no gain and all that rubbish, which is rubbish. And so I think there's a lot to be said for starting slow and gradually building up. And also having a thorough warm-up as well will be beneficial around pain. Getting started with resistance exercise can be very daunting and quite challenging. There are lots of things that people can do around the home. So in the home that count as resistance exercise. So a very simple one, sat on in your chair or sat on your sofa, standing up, sitting back down again, standing up, sitting back down again. You've just performed two body weight squats.
Surprisingly hard as well. Surprisingly challenging to see how many of those you can do in 1 minute was a test that I had from my physio.
Yes, absolutely. And they are very difficult. And so there are ways to make those easier. For instance, if that's not comfortable for you at the moment, there are ways that you can, for instance, put cushions underneath your bum when you sit down to make the distance that you're standing up a little bit less. There are also ways to make it harder, actually, if they are become over time quite easy for people. For instance, you could hold some books in your hand as you stand up to add some resistance. For other people might be interested in going to a gym. So it's absolutely, and again, it's just what works for you. Resistance exercise is important. It can be done at home with simple objects around the house. For example, having some cans of soup and lifting them above your head, for example. But some people may want to go to a gym, and that's fine as well. I would always suggest, if people haven't gone to a gym previously and it's something they are looking to start, is to proactively seek out support for that. That might simply be just going with a friend a couple of times in the first instance to build up some confidence around the exercises and the machines. And again, we've probably all experienced this, that we walk in, for those who have gone to a gym, you walk into a gym and you think, man, this is quite daunting. I've really no idea how to use this equipment and things. So going with someone who, a friend or someone you know, or even someone, a gym instructor who was able to induct you into the gym, is really beneficial. There are lots of different classes out there at the moment. Unfortunately, not cancer specific, which we hope to change through our project, but other community classes that people might consider going to as well, which usually circuit based, so involves some resistance exercise, but have an instructor there and different people there who are able to help.
I would also say services are completely different around the country, but I would say if anyone is in is currently being treated at a hospital, do ask your oncology your oncologist, or if you're given a breast cancer nurse, do ask them if there is a physio or if there are any exercise support services that they have, because from my experience, those aren't necessarily given to you on a plate, but if you ask, you often find that there is a service. And I've just had six amazing gym sessions over a 6-week course with my hospital physio, which was completely free and was absolutely life-changing, because it just gave me the confidence to use weights. And I actually, as you said, I started off with those 400 gram tins of beans at home, and so it can be free. And it can be much easier than you might think. And also, if somebody is a member of a gym already, often gyms give a free, maybe half hour session that's included like an induction. You don't necessarily have to pay a personal trainer to get started. So there are always ways to get started.
Yeah, absolutely. You make an absolutely fantastic point that asking that question with your healthcare provider is a really good place to start. And I'm a really big believer that for those of us who are able-bodied, we can be physically active. An exercise is for us, and I think that's a common belief that, again, we have these connotations of what exercise looks like, and we think, oh, okay, that's not for me. That's not who I am. I'm not a gym person. But you don't have to be to be physically active. And there's a lot to be said around building confidence around the ability to exercise that can then help propagate and sustain exercise in the future.
Yeah. And possibly even through breast cancer now, people can just be connected with another patient who then you might start something with, because obviously a lot of people do lack that confidence to just get started on their own. I know you're not a nutritionist, but I wonder if you do have any small tips on diet to supplement a healthy exercise routine. We know that alcohol and smoking is bad, but are there any particularly good foods that you could recommend, or any particular diet changes?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something else that it's probably worth clarifying, that this difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist. So I would consider myself as a nutritionist. I have the nutrition qualifications to support that. But what I'm not is a dietitian. And dietitians, they assess, they treat and diagnose dietary and nutritional problems, and they're able to recommend specific diets, for instance. As a nutritionist, I can provide general healthy eating guidance. And I think that's an important distinction to make. And I'm a big believer in staying in my own lane. I have some, it may surprise listeners, I have some expertise in some areas, but I'm the first one to say, hang on, I'm not an expert in this area. Let's have a chat with a colleague who is. So health, in terms of healthy eating for women who've had breast cancer, currently the best available evidence suggests following a healthy diet pattern that's very similar to what people have probably heard before for general health purposes. And that encompasses things like following a diet plan that helps maintain a healthy weight. Some other components of a healthy diet include eating a diet that's rich in whole grains, including fruits and vegetables, avoiding sugary drinks and limiting things like fast and processed foods, and as you just mentioned, limiting alcohol intake and not smoking. So there's no specific foods or that people should or shouldn't eat after breast cancer and its treatment, or at least at the moment, the current evidence doesn't suggest that. But following those healthy eating principles will be helpful to living well after breast cancer.
Sam, I would like to ask you the question we ask all our guests on this podcast, which is, what is the one thing you'd like to see change in the coming years in terms of breast cancer diagnosis, treatment, and beyond?
Great question. I would like to see physical activity and support and referral to be routinely offered as part of standard follow-up care for women who've had breast cancer and breast cancer treatment. I hope that our project called PureX can provide a feasible and acceptable and scalable model to be able to do that.
Fantastic. And is there anything else you'd like to share with us?
I guess I would like to finish on just a couple of takeaway key points. And that is, and I've said this a few times, that remember that being physically active is, for most of us, if not all of us, doing any physical activity is beneficial, any amount and any type, and doing more is better. It can bring a whole host of benefits. The strongest evidence is for improving things like fatigue, low mood, and there is emerging evidence now that physical activity after breast cancer treatment can help stop or reduce the risk of breast cancer coming back in the future. It doesn't completely eliminate the risk, but it does provide a small risk reduction. And I was actually just talking to one of our patient leads, Kelly Ross, about this, about and how this is put across to the public and people who've had breast cancer, to avoid any feelings of guilt. So after having breast cancer and having treatment and being in remission of breast cancer, being physically active after that can reduce the risk of breast cancer coming back by a reasonably small amount. So it can help. That does not mean even if you're highly physically active, you're always going to the gym, you're always going on runs, that breast cancer will come back. That's not what it means. What it means is, compared to if you weren't physically active at all, being regularly physically active, the risk of breast cancer coming back is lower. So, I think, a really important message, because when we speak to women who've had breast cancer, you know, reducing the risk of that cancer coming back is very much, understandably so, on the forefront of people's worries and their minds. So physical activity can help with that. It may help with things like, immune system activity, things like inflammation, and things like insulin resistance as well. So we don't have the exact reasons why yet, but there are lots of proposed mechanisms that do have some legitimacy to them.
Yes. I just wanted to say, if your breast cancer comes back and you haven't exercised, it doesn't mean that it's your fault. Similarly, because there are so many different factors that contribute to getting breast cancer in the first place and breast cancer recurrence, ranging from lifestyle to environment to genetics to so much more. So it's never your fault, I think, is the message that we want to get across on this podcast, which you've said about various things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, thanks for picking that up, Laura. And that's such an important message. And again, that was something I was speaking to our patient lead about, that both those sides, as you say, if you're not physically active and the breast cancer comes back, that is absolutely not your fault. And the other side as well, if you are very physically active, you can still get breast cancer. So you're right, those are really important messages to put across.
Where can people find out more about your work?
So they can go on the Breast Cancer Now website, which will be posting updates on our project. And the other way is via my staff page on Newcastle University's website. So if people are interested, if they Google Sam Orange, Newcastle University, that's probably the first thing that'll come up. And you can see different projects that I'm working on and papers that I've published on that website.
We will put all those links in the show notes as well, so you don't have to do any Googling. And the same with healthy eating tips. There's lots of those on the Breast Cancer Now website as well, so we'll put all those links in the show notes. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I wish you all the best for your research and your work. And I really hope we will see some brilliant results on the Breast Cancer Now website in the future. Dr. Sam Orange, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.